And good morning, everybody. And I hope you all are having a happy Friday, the 13th. This is episode 19 of the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces. I am your host, Coleman, and I have a very special guest coming up today, Joe Calasari. Welcome, sir. And we will be talking all things macro, getting Joe's insights. I really like following Joe. If you guys aren't following him, definitely give him a follow. I really use him to keep me grounded. It's really easy to get swept in with all the hype and the nonsense going on, but Joe really keeps me grounded. So I like following him. So happy to speak with him today. While we get more people funneling into the spaces, I just want to make sure that everyone understands what our purpose is here. And it's to defend the values that this nation was founded upon. We want to make sure we champion decentralized, trustless systems that empower individuals, communities, and small businesses, and to eliminate a central authority so we can advance the cause of a free and open society. We do this by harnessing the power of Bitcoin and promoting a world where every individual has the undeniable right to control their own destiny, their own assets, and their own privacy. We don't support tyranny in any of its forms, and we will use combined expertise and passion to ensure that the promise of liberty thrives. And together, we are going to continue our oaths to safeguard the ideals that define us. We are veterans, we are Bitcoiners, and most importantly, we are for freedom. Hoorah! And welcome everybody out there. I see AC out there, Wade, Hunter. Good morning, Gabe. Good morning, sir. I'll make sure today is nice and positive for you. I won't be all doom and gloom.
You know, man, yeah, yesterday things kind of took a different turn, but you know, that's all right because we need to have those conversations, man. And if everything was always really happy, then I don't think we would appreciate it as much. So even like fun and like entertaining, exciting movies, they all have their moments of doom and gloom and crisis because that's how we know when things turn around.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think we hit on some important topics, but again, it's not fun starting off really positive and then coming in on a down note. So we'll definitely be talking about some things that I think will be pretty positive. It looks like Joe might have just stepped down really quick. But once he gets back up here, I definitely want to get his thoughts on some of the things going on in the market. And I think a big thing going on right now that we're all pretty excited about is that MicroStrategy just bought $1.1 billion worth of Bitcoin. So they acquired 18,300 Bitcoin for an average purchase price of $60,408. So as of 9/12/24, MicroStrategy holds a combined 244,800 Bitcoin at an average price of $38,585 per Bitcoin. So just crazy numbers. Saylor is just, he's not slowing down whatsoever. I still believe he has about $900 million left on this ATM offering, which should be released probably about the second week of October. So he's not stopping the strain. Hey, good morning, Joe. How are you doing, sir?
Good morning, Coleman. Thanks for having me up. Excited to chat today about a variety of topics. So thanks. Whatever you want, we can dig in.
Yeah, definitely. And again, I want to thank you for coming up here. Like I said earlier, I do really like to follow you. You keep me grounded. Yourself and Dr. Jeff were the two people I like to follow. You guys have very similar theses and thoughts. And so when I know you both kind of turn bullish, that means things are about to get serious in the market. And I think I just saw you post a couple weeks ago, or maybe last week, that you saw one of your indicators turned bullish. Do you mind kind of elaborating on that?
Sure. So I'll give you my philosophy on like just overall markets first, if that's okay, if you don't mind.
Don't mind at all, sir.
Okay. So, and I think this is really important when you're having a macro discussion. And I come from, you know, just my background is, obviously I'm a lawyer, but prior to law school, I got a classical education in economics, right? So I learned all the rules and all the formulas and the Phillips curve and the yield curve. And I studied all those principles, right? And one of the things that I think helps me as a litigator coming into the macro space and just analyzing this, and in addition to my, you know, legal opinions, is that I recognize, and I think Bitcoin veterans will appreciate this, that the economy itself, despite efforts to reduce it down to a single formula or a simple input output calculation, it is a dynamic, evolving, changing system, right? It's really a battlefield, right? Where you have multiple different actors all competing, all reacting, all changing the variables at any given time. And the thing that I think is very frustrating about classical economics in general, and I think this is one of the reasons I'm drawn to Bitcoin, is that they try to teach you economics as if it's a science. They try to teach it to you as if there are hard inputs and outputs. And many people in FinTwit, who drive me absolutely crazy, try to adhere to these things. They try to tie models around things to justify their conduct. They'll tell you that you can't buy NVIDIA because it's trading at 30 plus forward PEs. They'll tell you that the yield curve almost invariably triggers a recession based on, you know, a handful of times in which that has occurred following the yield curve, when in reality, there are plenty of reasons to suspect that false positives might be, you know, might be triggered. So like when I look at indicators, when I look at anything, okay, I build it into a model of probabilities. My way of like, of trying to analyze any difficult problem is not to tell you what I think is certain to occur, but to try to give you a weight and a confidence level for that in a true Bayesian way, which is basically to say that I can't tell you the future, but I can tell you that the balance of probabilities favors one outcome over the other. And I think that helps keep me out of trouble in a lot of respects. I'm not perfect by any means, but when I look at conditions generally in the market and what drives asset prices, right? What is most significant for Bitcoin's price performance historically has been real rates. And I built out some indicators, which is basically, you know, interest rate adjusted for inflation, right? The real yield on interest rates. And as yield rate, real rates, meaning, you know, interest rates adjusted for inflation come down, that tends to be very positive for assets. That combined with liquidity conditions. And most of the time, and I built out a few of these things and messed with them in spare time, but most of the time when I'm looking at liquidity conditions, I think people always look at like the Fed balance sheet. They always look at like the central planners and their efforts to inject liquidity into the market, which to me, I think is only like about, I'd say 60% of the story. The reality is that liquidity can be actually expanding irrespective, and there's plenty of times history where it has, irrespective of what the policymaker is doing. And you would say, well, how does that work? How can liquidity expand if there's not more fiscal spending, if there's not more, you know, a monetary policy and QE and these things? And I'll give you a very simple example. If you, as a homeowner, have your house double in value in the span of several years, your liquidity, your balance sheet is much, much better. Your home value, your equity is incredibly better. Same thing goes with asset prices, right? When you have stocks and those stocks go up 30%, your access to liquidity, regardless of what the Fed's doing, regardless of what, you know, the US Treasury is doing, that increases significantly. Asset prices at all-time highs is positive liquidity. And I want to underline that. When people say, oh, well, the interest rates are really high, that's fine, but now I can borrow, you know, in my, because my stock portfolio is up, I can borrow $500,000 more in margin to pile back into stocks. And it's a positive loop. It's a virtuous cycle, right? As prices rise in assets, they push more liquidity in the market, and that can be self-fulfilling, right? It reinforces until it does, and it reverses. And the same is true on the downside. As liquidity is drained, as assets are crashing, everybody tightens up, everybody tightens their belt. They're not spending as much, they're not investing, and that's when the bottom can fall out. And we see this in Bitcoin, you know, when people are scared and fear rises in the market. But to go back to your original question, just to wrap up here, I look at a host of different things. I never say like, you know, I have any access to a crystal ball and I have any certainty about markets, but I do see plenty of indications that we're entering a period that is very positive for Bitcoin. And I expected for most of the summer to be chopped just because of how over our skis we got and how overheated some of the things I look at were with the launch of the ETFs. And now I think people are really, like you see, you see a lot of malaise and sort of almost depression set in because why aren't we pumping? Why are we at 100K? And the reality is that markets move when you least expect them. That's just how they do. When everybody's on the same side of the boat pushing it higher, it's pretty much exhausted move. And I think we saw part of that in the early to middle part of the year. Doesn't mean it's bearish. It just means it was in for consolidation. And markets correct in two ways. They correct in price and they correct in time. And although we haven't fallen back into the 40s and hasn't been for a significant amount of time, at least, we haven't fallen back there, you know, for any serious part. I think that the last 6 months have basically been a correction through time, not necessarily price, where we have built a very solid floor of support for the next move higher.
Oh, thank you for that. And so then you don't think the Fed cutting rates, you think that's the start of the catalyst for this next leg, or do you think that has little impact?
Definitely positive. It's not negative. You're never going to be able to convince me that cutting the Fed funds rate, which, by the way, the market has already cut the Fed funds rate. Just let's talk about that for a second. You and I, Coleman, we can't go borrow at the Fed funds. Like, what the overnight lending rate between banking institutions, that really is sort of immaterial. It matters for like short-term treasuries, which are very sensitive to the Fed funds rate. But, you know, if you're going out to get a mortgage right now, go check mortgage rates. Mortgage rates are in the sixes, okay? Not too long ago, they were 50, 70 bit higher. So that's already in the market. Similarly, look at like the 2 year, okay? The 2 year is now a 350. Okay, that has declined. Just to give you some context, it was back in June, it was a 5. Okay, so you've basically seen over 100 basis points of cuts on the 2 year. Now people say that's doom, that's very negative, and you get these people out here, shall remain nameless, that we'll talk about yield curve inversion and go on and on about how that every single time that has been, you know, some hard down in the markets and everything's falling apart. What you're seeing in terms of the bond market moves, in my view, are a recognition that number one, rate cuts are coming, but number two, that disinflation has taken hold. If you take out owner's equivalent rent from the CPI and PCE calculations, which I'll stipulate, I don't want to get in a rabbit into a side discussion, that those are flawed metrics, but if you take, they're used to inform policy decisions. If you take out owner's equivalent rent, we're sub 2% on inflation, sub 2%. Now, again, we can say that's a BS number, it doesn't matter, but that's what informs policy. So the market has responded to that. They basically, you know, listened to Powell, both at Jackson Hole and last FOMC, who said, listen, we don't need to get all the way down 2%. We're on a sustainable path there, and we're more concerned about the labor conditions right now, which again, people read that as a doomsday thing. No, that's basically saying, in Powell's own words, the balance of risk have come into parity, meaning that we're just as concerned about labor taking up too much as we are consumer prices, which means that they're pulling the foot off the gas, which means that you're going to see, I think, more messaging from the Fed that's going to try to get ahead of unemployment taking off. And I think that, you know, from my perspective, all of these things against the backdrop where people are overly defensive in terms of a recession with over 2% real GDP, lay the groundwork for a very strong bull market. You consistently see, I think the biggest message is you consistently see defensive posturing in the marketplace, and we could point to some of those things. And that is what you need. That's the wall of worry you climb for a bull market.
So then where do you think the Feds want to keep that rate at? How low do they want to drop it? What's their neutral rate going to be? And how does that affect the interest on our debt? That's the next thing that I see a lot of people talking about. I'll use Zero Hedge. They put in an article last night, and I know you're not a big fan of everything they post, but they're talking that we're in a tough place with the interest rates being this high with debt. I think they quoted there was $17 trillion going to be refinanced over the next 3 years. Doesn't that just accelerate James Lavish's theory that we're in a debt spiral? So how do we get out of that?
Yeah, I've heard this stuff, with all due respect to Mr. Lavish, I've heard it for 30 years, okay? I remember reading articles in high school about the debt spiral and the significant debts coming out of the Reagan era, okay? I find these arguments to lack a whole lot of credibility for a very simple reason. The rest of the world is in a far better, far worse situation, and they don't have access to a money printer, and they need to finance, to monetize debts where necessary. So the notion that the United States is in some sort of spiral where we'll be unable to pay, which is the implicit, you know, statement, I think there, that we will be unable to pay, they'll ever grow. Well, I mean, okay, first of all, we were at deficit GDP levels that were comparable coming out of World War II. What was different in World War II? What was different in World War II is that we came back, most of our major competitors were destroyed. We had, you know, protection largely from the war. We had facilities. We had a labor force that started to boom with the introduction of baby boomers. So we could grow our way out of it. Now, the question here is, without the demographic headwind, demographic tailwinds, without the positive demographics, which are destiny, right, behind us, can we grow our way out of it? Now, some people will point to things like AI and other efficiencies to say, like, can we grow out of these debt levels? And then, you know, you hear the Lynn Alden argument, which is a credible one, which is politically, we are not willing to make the sacrifices needed to pull back and pull back some of the spending. But the reality is, while I agree with Lynn on that, I think that politically, it's very difficult. The lavish argument I reject because I think that the math is very simple. If you were to raise retirement, here's just some basic stats on this. And this isn't, you can check my math on it. Go to Brookings, they did a study on this, go to others. If you were to raise the retirement age to more consistent with what it was historically with respect to Social Security and cut Medicare benefits, and you were to raise taxes, and combined with that, you were to trim 5% from the current military budget, which we can talk about whether that's good or bad. I'm just telling you the numbers. You do those things, you basically pull our, and you grow at a close to 3% trend. You're pulling our deficit to GDP in line with historical patterns. You're gonna pull debt levels under 100% deficit to GDP, or debt to GDP, excuse me, which is, you know, where we hung out most of the 80s and 90s. So I'm not saying at all, and I wanna be very clear, that's extremely difficult politically. But the notion that it's impossible, that there's no way to do it, I reject that. I think it takes extremely strong, dynamic leaders and shared sacrifice, which we may not have the constitution for. That's a different question, but it's not a debt spiral. I mean, the fact that there's no way to come out of this, the math tells you that's wrong.
How much would you have to raise taxes in this scenario? I didn't catch.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So you're going to have to actually raise taxes on the top 50% earners in the country, and they're going to have to go up somewhere, you know, by the estimates between 5 to 6%. So really painful, right? Like, I'm not saying anybody can really stomach that type of tax increase right now, but it's not impossible. Like, it's not like, you know, something that's beyond the realm of reason. And again, the model forecast I'm talking about, it assumes 3% growth. And this is the biggest challenge I think people need to focus on. When you are in an over indebted situation, every time in history, there's three ways people get out of it. Austerity, okay? Which is, you know, cutting back and raising taxes, that's austerity. Growth or war, where you can somehow increase your national net worth by confiscating other assets. So let's talk about what the easiest path forward is for trying to deal with the debt situation. It's growth. It's getting back to growing in this country. It's wiping out unnecessary regulations. It's being more positive for small businesses. It's making it easier for people to build the next great company in the United States. It is getting rid of bureaucracy and things that I think hamper people and things that pull people aside and say, you can't go start this business or start this endeavor because it's too difficult. If you were to do that and you get growth rate that starts to trend higher, that is going to make the debt much more manageable. And this is the fallacy people always say when they're talking about debt, okay? I don't care how much debt you have. Tell me about the income side. Talk about GDP growth. Our country's GDP growth relative to the rest of the world has grown at a faster clip over the last 10 years, meaning we have a greater share of the world GDP. Why is that? Now we can say it's AI and, you know, other innovations. Doesn't matter. What matters is that we have to continue that trend. That is what allowed us to get out of the quote unquote debt spiral in the 40s. We had positive growth. We had real growth, meaning adjusted for inflation. If you get back into growth again, you can sustain higher debt levels. And I think people know this intuitively. Again, a country is very different from a household when it comes to income and balance sheets. But I think you know that if I've got a lot, I better get my butt out there and start making more money. And then I can service that debt and I can get my way out of this and I can get to a point where, you know, that level becomes more manageable.
Then I do have a question for you. We get growth, the interest rate doesn't matter. The debt is going to slowly start paying for itself with the new growth and greater income. How do we solve the Social Security issue? I believe, I forget who posted it, but their their projections were that by the year, I think 2035, they're not going to have money to pay out Social Security.
Yeah. Either. And that is a great question. So let me just say, rephrase. Okay. I don't know if I ever said interest rates don't matter. They do matter. Okay. Interest rates matter tremendously. Now let's talk about where interest rates are at. Interest rates were jacked up because that is the main tool the Fed has. Like it or hate it, blame them all you want. That is their main tool for trying to pump the brakes on higher consumer prices. So when everybody shows us, look at these deficits exploding, look at these interest rates going through the roof, that is purposeful, guys. They know that they are going to have to take that short-term pain of jacking up and spending a lot more money on interest rates. If they had any, and this is their minds, right? I don't necessarily agree with this. I think consumer prices would have come down regardless of what the Fed does, because I think the Fed is not as important as people seem to think. But if they wouldn't have jacked up interest rates, okay, you're talking about trillions of dollars that would not have flown into, trillions would have not flown into the economy and increased the debt. Simply because that money goes to someone. I mean, everybody, I think they forget this when you're going talking about interest rates, right? When everybody shows you how, I mean, somebody posted yesterday, the government spent $300+ billion in a deficit last month. I saw this on Twitter. Well, yeah, that's because you're sitting at Fed funds with 3.35 effective. Who do you think is getting that money? It's money markets. It's people in short-term treasuries. It's Google. Google got a ton of money from the cash they have in their balance sheet from the federal government. So what happens, Coleman, when you decrease interest rates? What do you think that does to the deficit? I mean, it's pretty simple, right? They needed to get consumer prices in line so that they could then cut. That was the whole thesis. Nobody has ever said interest rates are going to remain high forever. I don't think even Powell said that. If you look at the summary of economic projections that the FOMC releases, they think that, you know, by sometime in 2026, interest rates are going to be about 150 bips lower. We'll see if they can get that and they can pull that off with the structural inflation you're dealing with. But that's another story. The point is, like, you have to get consumer prices lower, because so the Fed, we're making this real simple. I'm sorry we're going on and on. I apologize. But there's something called in economics called the natural rate of inflation, right? And the natural interest rate. The natural interest rate is the interest rate where it's basically Fed policy is in balance. It's neither restrictive, they call it R-star, neither restrictive nor accommodative. And we are in a restrictive, meaning that the natural interest rate is lower, meaning that we're going to have to cut at some point when we no longer want to be restrictive to bring down consumer prices. Okay, so if you establish that framework, okay, I think the natural rate of inflation, given the debt level, is substantially lower, potentially, you know, as much as 200 bips lower. And once you get to those levels, low interest rates make that more, you know, tolerable. So they need to get consumer prices down, which means they need to stop the inflation impulse, which seems that whether they did it or something else did it, supply chain bottlenecks being removed, it's coming down. Once it gets to a level that is acceptable to the Fed, right, they're going to cut to bring it in line. And at that point, you've already had a positive effect on the deficit.
So then, do you mind answering the other part of that question would be, how do we pay for Social Security after 35?
So I think that if you study history about the Social Security program, and again, I'm not saying this is politically easy to do. It's very problematic. It'll require real leadership and sacrifice. But if you study Social Security, it was never intended to be servicing the amount of people we have. I understand people paid into the benefit, but when those programs were created, life expectancy was nowhere near what it is today. You had, you know, a much smaller percentage of the population living 65 and then sitting on Social Security for decades. With greater life expectancy, okay, you have to acknowledge, I believe, and I say this as somebody who, you know, I've got family members who draw on Social Security. You have to acknowledge that the program cannot begin at 65. You have to do things like means testing, which, you know, they were trying to, conservatives were trying to push that forward years ago, where if you're extremely wealthy, you're not gonna be able to draw on Social Security. You have to do things like raising the eligibility age to draw on Social Security. Not popular things, right? Joe running on that platform for the US Senate would get precisely zero votes, pink. Particularly when cohorts that are very reliable voters, seniors, hear their benefits may be slashed, or they have they might have to, you know, wait 10 more years before drawing on Social Security. But I'm not telling you what is popular. I'm trying to tell you what is the solution to the problem. And what I find so frustrating is these people that just say, woe is me, we're in a debt spiral. There's nothing we can do. It's all going to fall apart. That's not leadership. And I would have hoped that people like Bitcoin veterans would appreciate, you know, telling people what it is and telling the truth. You know, we're going to have to tighten our belts.
I think we can all agree with you on that. I just don't know if we have the leadership currently out there right now in power to make those decisions.
Agreed.
Yeah. So I want to welcome up lowercase Terrence. Good morning, sir. Uppercase Terrence. Good morning, sir. And AC. Good morning, guys. Do you have any questions for Joe?
No, just wanted to say, hey, Joe, glad to have you here. It's always good to hear your practical and measured takes. I've for a long time learned a lot from Joe and appreciated his defending sort of the wall of logic from all of the bears and the doomers and the gloomers. Because I've always questioned when all these narratives come out that like the world is falling apart. And it's like, yeah, you know, we have a printing machine. We have a Fed. We have a central bank. We know the levers, we know what they can do, but, you know, and maybe they're doing the best they can. Maybe they're making mistakes. And oftentimes in the short term, unless we zoom out, everything could feel oppressive or like they're just fucking around with fiat. But, you know, when you zoom out and you look at history, it's like, well, they're doing what they do. And as Bitcoiners, we don't like what they do, but it doesn't mean everything's falling apart. And
well,
Joe highlights that.
I appreciate that, Terrence. I just want to be clear about, you know, my view on this. I one of the reasons I spend time talking about Bitcoin is because I realize the system has so many flaws. And I think it's fundamentally flawed, okay? I think it needs to have serious reform. Yeah. That's why I talk about Bitcoin. That's why I appreciate Bitcoin for what it can be. That is not to say that I believe that tomorrow we're going to wake up and be eating cat food under a bridge. Okay, that's like a totally different sort of idea. And I think that's what a lot of people prey on. They prey on, you know, for sensationalism to get people to, you know, to buy Bitcoin. They say things that I think are absurd. No, we can just talk about how it's a better system. We can talk about how it's preferable to what the current status is. And that's not to say that, you know, we should be, you know, a lot of people hear what I say and they think like, oh, well, Joe, what about credit cards getting maxed out and the poor struggling more and middle class and like, yeah, I'll stipulate to all that. Income inequality, wealth inequality, serious problems. You know, we have a hollowing out of the middle class. We have the fundamental things that made America great for most of the 20th century. We're losing our grip on them. Okay. And I don't discount any of that. You know, I talk about it all the time. I think it's a real problem. The lack of opportunity, the disillusionment about a society and the fact that, you know, you had last year, guys, okay, I still can't get over this statistic. You had more people die of opioid overdoses than car accidents in the United States. Now, if you know anything about that, that's a stunning statistic, right? The fact that we have people literally killing themselves because of how upset and depressed they are in this country is, you know, many veterans, right? That's a serious problem. And it's not to diminish that at all. People always say like, oh, you know, things are gonna break down. They're going to collapse. They've broken. Like you're seeing it on the streets every day. You're seeing it and it's the slow boiling of the frog, but it's still there. And I think that, you know, like the T.S. Eliot quote, it doesn't have to be some bang where everything blows up and you read it on the New York, you know, page of the New York Times front page. It's a slow burn. It's very painful. It destroys people's lives. And that's it. The world, like T.S. Eliot quote, the world doesn't end with a bang. It ends with a whimper. And this is the society we're seeing. We're seeing it whimper under the stress of policies that are designed to keep the plate spinning in the air. And by the way, they're very effective at doing that. It doesn't mean it's good. It just means they're very effective at keeping it cobbled together.
Thank you for that, Joe. And so I'd like to touch on something you mentioned there with policy. We have the election coming up soon, about 45 days. If a Harris, we've heard Donald Trump speak about how he's pro-crypto, pro-Bitcoin. He's trying to launch...
World Liberty Financial, right?
He's trying to launch his own bank, which is a little alarming. But my question for you would be, with a Kamala victory or a Harris victory, do you see that impacting anything negatively for the Bitcoin society?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm very suspicious of the lip service that the folks around Vice President Harris have given to the space. And when I say suspicious, I try to be open-minded and optimistic. We'll see what she does. But I really hope that she gets some reformers and more open-minded people if she were to win. Like I said, I'm skeptical and suspicious, but I don't know. I think my biggest concern with VP Harris is campaign is that I think she's being purposely vague about the crypto policy and the Bitcoin policy. And as a litigator and as my day job, you know, fighting for, you know, companies and people that have been, I think, unfairly prosecuted by the government and also prosecuted by various aspects of the three letter agencies, which you mean like the SEC and CFTC. I want somebody to be more sensible about, you know, policy and think holistically. And I hope that, you know, more open-minded Democrats on the Hill are trying to get forward better legislation for the space and trying to help people. I think it's absolutely appalling for, you know, a SAB 1 and 21, right? Like that we can't get her on the record as to whether she would have vetoed it, whether she would have, you know, departed from what her boss did. I think that it needs to be on the record. I'm a voter. I want to know the answer to that. And whether it's reporters that are failing or her just not giving access, I don't really care. The fact that I have to make a choice without any informed, you know, basis for that choice with respect to this particular issue, which matters a great deal to me, that's not how elections are supposed to work. People shouldn't hide from voters and not give their opinions and say things like, well, you'll hear what my plan is after I get elected on both sides. That's nonsense, guys. Like we should not allow that from the Trump campaign. We should not allow that from the Harris campaign. People should state their views because how am I to make an informed choice without them?
You just have to go with your gut feeling.
Yeah, I know, right? But and we will, right? Because we have to. But it's a shame.
No, it is, and there should be just clear. Just come out with your stance, and if you're pro, if you're for it, that's great. If you're against it, you know, that's your choice. But at least the voters know where you stand on it. That I agree that there should just be something out there where their stance is clear.
I have a different take on that. So the Harris campaign, one of her top people has said that they're going to have a pro-digital asset growth mindset. She's obviously a former prosecutor at multiple levels, DA and AG, and has reportedly said that Bitcoin is a scam privately. And I think that when you see the average American lose their life savings are a lot of money for them in crypto, whether they're scams on or off Bitcoin, mostly off Bitcoin on Solana, Ethereum, or from those two coins. You're not going to be that pro crypto. So I think she can have a balanced policy eventually, but obviously it's not important enough for her. They did a calculation. Voters don't care enough. Or it's kind of a wash between the pro-Bitcoin, pro-scam crowd, pro-crypto scam crowd versus the people who have been scammed and never want to have anything to do with crypto, whether they lost money in 2021 on NFTs or 2017 in ICOs or currently through Trump's Trump family's multiple crypto scams. They're just not going to take a view because they made the calculation that it's either a wash or voters don't care enough or both. So
yeah, that's not really Terrence, you and I have talked many times and I'm not defending the scam artists. I've sued many of them in the space. Okay. I think my views on this are known. I'm pro Bitcoin. I'm not pro crypto generally. That's different to say when you're talking about Harris, okay, putting something on your website that is we're for pro crypto sensible policy. That is word salad. That doesn't mean anything. Tell me, you know, the devil is in the details. Give me specifics. Tell me specifically, you know, and you could be hostile towards scam artists. You could say that. I want to bring prosecutions against these things. You know, comment on the Coinbase litigation. Does he think the SEC should currently be embroiled in a litigation where they're saying Coinbase doesn't have a right to exist as an exchange? Maybe so. Maybe that's the right policy, right? But don't hide from it. And what you just said basically is kind of verifying the point. The calculation is we're not going to say anything because it may hurt us with some voters. That's not leadership. Okay. And again, I'm open minded. I would love to have a good option. Okay. On these issues, I can't even tell you what the policy is. It's merely just, you know, we're going to figure it out later and you're going to have to deal with it if we win.
Yeah, I hear you. So I think it's like how most politicians, when they run for president, they don't have a policy on Taiwan on their site because it's too divisive. You have, at least now, a lot of mainland Chinese, many of whom are spies. Kidding, not kidding. But you have a lot of mainland Chinese pouring money, and some of them are eligible to vote in the U.S. And China is pretty big and powerful. And then you have people who want to defend Taiwan like the way we defend Israel. And it's just not something that has a lot of upside. So that's why they don't come out on it. I think if I had a guess, as a former prosecutor, she's anti-scam and she wants to keep prosecuting those, which is extremely unpopular with the let us scam in peace crypto bros, whether it's Mark Cuban, who allegedly talked to the Harris campaign multiple times a week. He hasn't donated, but he talks to them. And then there are others, Ro Khanna, who's a congressman, and others who are pro-Bitcoin, pro-crypto, trying to affect policy. It takes time, and it's obviously not a top priority. You'll notice that Trump never brought up Bitcoin or crypto, CBDCs, Ross Ulbricht. He could have at any time opening his mouth, and he runs his mouth a lot during the debate, right? I understand the moderators never asked that, but that didn't stop him from bringing up eating cats and dog, the Poland strongman, so forth.
But I think we've heard Trump speak about it, whether it was crypto or Bitcoin. I think he has mentioned Ross about letting him out. So we've heard point that the opposite side should come out and say, you know what, I agree with them, or you know what, I don't. I think they're just being vague for a reason.
I mean, just like Trump won't debate again, right? He wanted to debate Biden multiple times. The Trump campaign is very smart. The Harris campaign is very smart. Harris is better at debating than Trump, so that's why he doesn't want to debate her again. There's not a lot of upside. They made the calculation that Trump will probably win, notwithstanding this modest or minor Harris bump from the debate. Trump brought it up, but not on the debate, right? And so the Harris campaign hasn't talked about it, and they've made a decision, and hopefully they'll change. It takes pressure. But I think having the Bitcoin community, led by David Bailey from quote-unquote Bitcoin Magazine, and others just kind of being all in on Trump, RFK Jr., complain about Harris and not giving money, not kind of trying to engage with the campaign, means that she's just going to continue to get advice from Mark Cuban and other people who hate Bitcoin and hate Maxis.
Yeah, but I'll just read it. She needs to make a stance. There's 45 days, come up with a policy, so we're not left.
Apparently, Bitcoiners don't matter.
I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to switch the topic really quick because I know, Joe, you're not a big fan of gold. But I do want to mention it's making some big moves over the last couple of days. And I'd like to get your thoughts.
Is decade structurally higher deficits and interest rates coming down relative to the rate of consumer price increases, i.e. the real rate. So all of those factors are positive for gold. They're also positive for a lot of equities. They're also positive for Bitcoin. Now, the question is always, as an investor, is not, you know, if all these things are rising, what horse do you want to bet on? If they're all going to run, who's going to be the fastest? That's the real question. And for me, I think in the long run, that's going to be Bitcoin. In the short run, I think it can be gold, it can be equities, et cetera. What I'm looking at, which I think is the biggest structural change we may have, is I frequently post the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, and the Bitcoin chart as measured in gold. And if you look at all of those charts, none of those asset classes have made a new high against gold for several years now. Now, that can be a response to the higher levels of consumer prices coupled with the higher fiscal spending and, you know, the nothing stops it argument. Or alternatively, this could be the interlude between an explosive move higher in equities, in Bitcoin, in the other classes relative to gold. I always say the party for me at Bitcoin is going to really start once you break an all-time high against gold. I think that although we made a nominal new high, you have to look at that nominal new high in the context of some of the highest consumer price increases in history, meaning that the purchasing power of Bitcoin at, you know, 69K or whatever, you know, we went to, it still is, was significantly lower than the purchasing power we had back in the last bull run in 2021.
And really quick, Joe, what is that number that Bitcoin has to reach before it breaks that threshold?
So you can, it depends on what the rate of inflation is, right? Like if you want to use Trueflation, their current calculation on their websites in the high 80s. If you want to use the CPI, which, you know, we can stipulate undercounts inflation, that is in the lower 80s. Okay. If you want to use gold, I think you're going to, by way of gold, it's even higher. Because gold's been, you know, doing really well. So we can have all these arguments about, you know, what is the proper rate of inflation and all that. I'll just say that I think that we can agree on the fact that the purchasing power of Bitcoin at its all-time high in 2021 is not what the purchasing power of Bitcoin is today.
Absolutely. I think we can all agree on that. I want to welcome Texas Toast and Alex to the stage. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Morning.
Do y'all have any questions for Joe?
Do I? No, I just want to say it's nice to see you in here, Joe. Also,
hi, Alex.
Hi, buddy. A couple of quick points that people probably are already aware of, but I just felt like I needed to say them is number one, apparently, Donald Trump is a shitcoiner. Number two, Haitians are eating people's pets. That one was for Terrence, by the way. And number three, guess we might be heading into World War III right now. What the hell is going on?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to hit on that, but I wanted to use this opportunity to ask you a bunch of questions because prior to today, I was the macro guy. And I'm sure nobody learned anything new when I was talking macro. So I definitely wanted to quit everything up and get Joe's take on everything. But yeah, it looks like we could be escalating into some seriousness over the weekend. Okay, Joe, you are Jerome Powell. You're talking on the 18th. What are you doing a 25 basis point? Are you doing a 50 basis point? Or are you going to do something in between?
You're doing a 25 basis point because of expectations and you believe down to your core. And there's been so much reporting of this, but I'll summarize it in like, you know, 30 seconds. You believe down to your core that the proper role of a Federal Reserve chairman is to not spook the markets. That you really regret having to leak to Nick Timiraos back in 2022. In fact, you said it's probably your biggest disappointment as a Fed chair that you've had to leak. There was a 50 basis point during a blackout window, which was basically, you know, illegal. They couldn't do that. They shouldn't have done that to a private reporter because you were spooked about consumer prices, and you don't want to do that again. You want to give forward expectations to the marketplace. You want to communicate very clearly what you think rate policy is going to be on a going forward basis. You told people at the last FOMC very specifically that if the prints on a going forward basis came in line at expectations were slightly lower than that, that you were going to cut and that the cut would be modest. Those are your words. So for you to come out and spook the market with a 50 bit cut, I think is implausible, very unlikely. The same is also true of no cut. You've told the market that if the prints came in line or under expectations, there would be policy adjustment. You went out of Jackson Hole and you told people that, again, repeatedly, that you thought it's time to adjust the policy rate. So everything has pointed towards 25 and you got to be a man of your word, otherwise you lose integrity. And from that standpoint, I think your hands are tied. I don't see any way they can get ahead of at least a 25 cut. I also think they basically told the market to expect at least one more cut in the months after. And then the question becomes, what happens next? Now, what you've said to the marketplace is that you do not expect the pricing of aggressive cuts to come to fruition. Market is pricing in, you know, well over 100 bips of cuts over the next 6 to 12 months. I'm very skeptical of that. I think it's far more likely they do a couple cuts to bring it down. They use that as sort of forward protection for the labor market. And it's, again, I don't think it will give any forward protection, but put that aside. You. I think that this time next year, I would not expect the rates to be, you know, sub 2% like some of the doomers are telling you. I think you're going to be, you know, probably in somewhere thereabouts in the fours to high threes. And it's going to stay there for longer than people expect.
Well, thank you for that. That's good to know. I definitely want to touch on a little bit on what Alex had brought up. So again, Joe, get your views on this, but I definitely want to thank you so much for coming on here and talking macro. I really appreciate this. And again, you're more than welcome to stay on and get your insight on this. But is there, in case you jump off, is there anywhere we can direct people that to follow you or to listen to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty active on Twitter. You can, if you have a legal dispute, okay, I do have a day job. I handle all sorts of disputes, both in the Bitcoin, quote unquote, crypto space, as well as, you know, outside. So breach of fiduciary duty, fraud claims, breach of contract, tortious claims, both on the defense and prosecuting those claims. So if anybody has any litigated disputes, you know, please feel free to reach out, significant value losses, that type of thing. One thing before I go, okay, which I really just want to impart to people here. If you're going to watch what is most important in the economy, okay, what is the first sign that there's going to be trouble on the horizon? Because people always accuse me of being too Pollyannish about the state of things. Look at the credit spreads, okay? Look at where credit conditions are and look at the risk appetite for fear. If you type in, and there's the Bank of America options adjusted spread on the Fred website. If you type in credit spreads Fred, I think, which is the Fed website, Fred, there'll be that chart that is pulled up. And you can literally see in the marketplace when those spreads start to widen, that's when fear starts to really take hold. And that actually is a fairly good warning indicator of things blowing up. That's what you want to look at. You want to look at the stock market is always a derivative of the credit market. So you have to look at what the credit conditions are telling you right here. And although rates have come down significantly, you haven't seen spreads blow out. They were very tight. And that is telling you that at least as it stands right now, there's not some, you know, economic collapse on the horizon. So sorry for trailing off on that, but I just want to leave you with that. You know, a lot of times people say, well, what do we look at? What is reliable? And the spreads are the key.
Perfect. We'll keep that in mind. And again, Joe, I don't want you to think we're chasing you off the stage. Please stay on here as long as you'd like. But I definitely want to hit on kind of the big stuff that Alec had just mentioned. And that's they're eating our pets. They're eating our cats. They're eating our dogs. They're coming for all of our pets. No, in case nobody heard, I'd mentioned it yesterday that Secretary Blinken was overseas and he was talking with the UK ambassador. That it looks like they're greenlighting the use of long-range weapons to be launched deep into Russia. And Putin has come out directly before the statement and said that that would be crossing a red line. And yesterday he gave a short little speech. And so this is what he had to say on the topic. NATO is escalating a direct war with Russia, and the U.S. and Britain discussing allow NATO-provided weapons to be used by Ukraine to strike targets inside of Russia. This would be a significant way to change the very nature of the conflict. It would mean that NATO countries, the US, the European, are at war with Russia, and we will respond accordingly. And so I definitely like to get everybody's thoughts on kind of what's going on with this.
Well, it seems like the short-range missiles won't reach, so they needed to bring out the long-range ones. That's what I saw.
It's just the same thing that's been happening for 15 years. Further encroachment. They weren't trying to up the pressure on Russia and doesn't seem to be stopping. So,
Alex, I don't think I've heard your thoughts on this, if you don't mind sharing.
I'm still processing all of it, to be honest. I haven't come to any conclusions at all, really. I just think that it's probably not wise to escalate, yet here we are escalating. I don't think that the United States is in a great position to be creating larger and larger conflicts. I just don't think that's smart. Maybe this is just part of the, you know, the arc of an empire, right? Like an empire, all empires peak, I guess, and then eventually they start going down the other side. So maybe this is just a further indication of going down the other side. You know, I think that probably didn't really start with the withdrawal of Afghanistan, but the withdrawal of Afghanistan and the way that was conducted was a pretty obvious signpost on the road. And, you know, for guys that are former military or active duty, I think every one of us look at that as like, that was a big failure. And so, I mean, I guess next steps here would be a big failure on the battlefield, right? Or, you know, on the high seas, if it's a naval engagement. But I suspect that if we keep doing stupid things like this, we're going to end up in that situation where that's going to get tested. And I don't think the test is going to be good.
Hey, Alex, a question for you on this. I'm curious.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want to get into conspiracy theories. I love the facts. Okay. What do you think? We're 60 days from an election, what I expect a very turbulent election, very different candidates, whether you like them, hate them, doesn't matter. They're very different ideologically. If you're assessing things from a geopolitical standpoint, from a military standpoint, what is the play here, or if any, I don't know, maybe there's no factor from Putin and Russia in light of the election that's coming. Is there any calculus in your mind that they're saying, we want to take action to make one candidate more or less increase the chances of one candidate, and who you think that might be, if so?
Yeah, that's a really a great point, and I don't have an immediate answer for it. I'd have to think that one through a little more, to be honest. But how would you consider? Okay, I look at it like this: like Trump has pretty clearly said many times that he hasn't said he doesn't want the war, but there wouldn't be war if he was the president. I mean, maybe you believe that, maybe you don't. I do recall that when he was president, we had a lot less conflict. There was still conflict, but the conflicts that we did have were wrapped up pretty fast. ISIS, for example, was, you know, stopped pretty much dead in their tracks, from what I understand. You know, what would be the advantage in your mind of ramping up things in Ukraine right now? And how would that benefit one candidate over another? I don't see it clearly.
I don't either. That's why I'm wondering. I'm just processing it. Is there, whenever you're this close to an election, right? You have to at least wonder, is some foreign actor doing something for the purpose of trying to push the needle one way or the other? And people may think I'm trying to argue, oh, well, you know, Russia's trying to help Trump or something. I'm not. I'm more just, you know, is this an embarrassment for Biden? Is this an embarrassment for whoever? I'm wondering if it has any impact, if you think it's completely separate from the political silly season we're in.
Yeah, I mean, there's two parts of that, right? There's the U.S. side, and then there's the Russia side. Like, you have to ask the question on both parts. Who in the United States would benefit from a continued and escalated war, you know, over there? And how does Russia look at that? Like, from what I understand, Putin has sought peace on multiple occasions, and basically we've shot him down. So I do not understand why that would be the case, but my understanding is that's the case. I suspect Putin is ready to be done with this war. And I think Trump is also like of the mind, let's be done with this war. And this is just my opinion. I have no facts to back this up. I don't really know. But what I do know is that some people are financially incentivized to escalate the war. And that's been the case for a very long time. You ask any guy in the military who's gotten out, and you know, a lot of these guys have figured out, it's like, damn, we did all this stuff for what? I mean, the military... We're lining the pockets of these people who make the bombs and the missiles and the guns and all that other kind of stuff. And they're getting extremely wealthy. How much money is the United States spending on this stuff? I think we've sent $350 billion worth of aid to Ukraine or something like that. Maybe that number's wrong, but it's a lot. That's what I know, is it's a lot. And the question I have is why? I don't know. I just don't. I personally don't support it. I would be curious to see if President Trump or to go on Twitter and just take a poll and say, how many Americans support the war in Ukraine versus do not? and it was a Twitter poll, kind of like Elon does. I'd be very curious to see the results of that.
I think the war is being pushed by the current party in the administration. I believe that there was a report that came out that said that we didn't pursue for a peace deal earlier last year. We told Ukraine to keep going because they could get more land back. And so the way I look at it is, if I was an adversary, if I was Russia and I wanted to go in and attack the United States, if I thought that Trump was going to win, I would wait till right after January 5th or 6th, right when there's a transfer of power. I think that would be the opportune time to strike because there's so much chaos going on. There's switching rules. People aren't really familiar. I think that would be the opportune time. I think if they're trying to stir up the war right now, I would assume it has something to do with the current administration. There's a lot of distraction going on there. And, you know, you can look at 9/11. It brought the country a lot closer during that. So you can look at that. The leaders in power get taken in a different light. And so if it's a positive outcome for us, that could benefit the current administration.
Yeah, there's a rally around the flag, right? I mean, maybe that's the answer. I don't know. If that's true, Coleman, that you think it helps the current administration, is this all just a concerted effort to get a rally around the flag and boost the incumbent party? But I'm sure Simon has the answer.
Yeah. Good morning, Simon. Welcome.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'll try and give a non-American perspective. And I believe that UK and US are joined at the hip anyway, so it's the same entity with my ex-government. With regards to it all depends if you believe that the government is the ultimate power structure. You know, in my map of the world, you have a hierarchy. You have the central bank on the top, which calls the shots. You have intelligence agencies. And then you have the government underneath, and the central bank and the intelligence agencies decide who's in charge and who's in the next election. So, you know, that's my map of the world. But that aside, you have to make an assessment over who is the aggressor here. And so if you look at the three different fronts, and obviously we know the military industrial complex, UK, US, they do benefit from war as long as it doesn't impact them on the ground. And so, you know, NATO has absolutely been the aggressor. I believe that NATO wants to expand to both the Middle East East and West Asia. And so you've got those three fronts that have been poking the bear, as it were. You know, if you look at the history of Iran, Iran is painted as the aggressor, but the Greater Israel Project has always been known. And that was a large contributor to what the West was sold as a war on terror. It was actually prevention mechanism of the Greater Israel Project as a sole nuclear power that wanted to take over many different regions. Covert operations in the US have led to Iranian coups, Iranian changes of leadership, various other things over time. That led to a revolution, and then a revolution leads to deals being negotiated around Iran, trying to be more inclusive in the world, putting together nuclear deals, and then those nuclear deals are torn up, and each administration changes the rules and gets more and more aggressive. So that's the Middle East side. You know, there was a very clear rule around Ukraine being sat in the middle between Europe and Russia. And there were rules and boundaries, and there were agreements. US executed a coup, changed its governments in, the many different covert operations that we've been told about, that we now know from WikiLeaks and all the documents to back it all up. And then you end up with, a violation of the Minsk agreement, and Russia feeling like US is violating all of the rules. And so Russia is painted as the aggressor in the US, but really it's trying to protect its borders, given that all of the NATO aggression in complete violation of all of the agreements is being pushed and pushed and pushed. And every time Putin tried to join NATO, which was a request that he actually made, you know, the the president, like the different administrations would agree to it. And then the CIA would turn up and say, no, that's no longer happening. And so these agreements would be reversed. America. Wait,
can I, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can you, when you say the CIA turned up and said, no, that's not okay, how do you know that? Like, what makes you say that?
Well, I look at two different narratives. So rather than just looking at the Western narrative, I also look at what's being told on the other side. And then you read the people that were involved in these negotiations and all the literature that they've published. So if you read books like Covert Regime Change, people that were involved in these different things, and then the WikiLeaks leaks and documents, and then you start to put together a story. We cannot fully know, but when you get outside the American propaganda and the British propaganda, you get to see a very, very different story. And then you put it together with who benefits from it, and you realize that it is definitely the US military industrial complex and the UK military industrial complex that benefits from it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. And again, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but I wanted to quick say good morning and shout out to Greg Foss in the audience. We haven't seen Greg Foss in a while. Welcome back, brother. I hope you come up and start hanging out with us and talking again. I think almost all of Bitcoin Twitter misses you dearly, except for the haters. Fuck those guys.
Yeah, Foster, if you get a chance to come up here, we'd love to hear you talk. It's good to see you back. And thank you, Simon, for going in through that. It was really good.
Yeah, there is one more fun. I won't go too deep, but America committed to a one China policy. And now, those agreements have been changed. And in the Biden administration, they started sanctioning Taiwan so it can't send chips to China. The trade war has been an ultra, ultra aggressive move, which is pushing China to want to do the one China policy, which is a policy that America had actually agreed to. And so the trade war and the sanctions and the sanctioning across all of those three regions is what's now leading to, this kind of desire for a multipolar world, a de-dollarization movement. But everyone was kind of happy with the status quo, but America and the UK weren't.
A very interesting view from someone up inside the United States. Really quick, I want to give a quick thank you to our partners who help us make this show possible. I want to give a quick shout out to Punchplate. I see you all in the audience. Good morning, guys. Go to punchplate.com and check them out. Stamp your hardware wallet, your seed phrase, on a metal plate. If you leave it on your paper, it's susceptible to getting wet and getting damaged, fire to get burned. So check them out at punchplate.com. Also check out Solo Satoshi, at home, small mini Bitcoin miner. Check them out at solosatoshi.com and decentralize the mining system. And also check out Palladium Tower. They're our newest partner. Palladium Tower offers professional grade firearms and tactics training to equip men, women to be protectors of life. The owner and lead instructor, Scott Wiley, is a combat veteran and former airborne infantryman who fought in Afghanistan. Check them out at palladiumtowers.com. And again, I want to welcome everybody in the audience who's listening. Death and Bitcoin, I see out there, Randy K. I really appreciate it. You guys listening in and tuning in. Does anyone else have, or we're a little past the top of the hour, but we have a good conversation going, so I don't want to stop it here. Anyone else have anything they want to continue on?
I have a quick comment. I'm driving, so I don't know if Bob is still in the audience, but I loved how Joe brought up credit spread as a marker for like an early warning sign of problem in the U.S. economy. I totally agree with that. And that was something, educated a lot of us on about. So.
Yeah, I agree with that. I concur. That was a very good piece of information. And checking credit spreads as a determinant of whether things are unraveling or not, like that's really smart.
Well, if anyone else doesn't have anything they'd like to touch on or mention today, I think we'll go ahead and start wrapping it up with some final comments from everybody on the panel. Let's just go ahead, and if anyone has anything to say,
I'd like to, if you guys don't mind, oh, Simon's bailing. I was going to ask him what he thought about the U.S. election, if he had an opinion. I'm very curious to see, like, what a non-U.S. person thinks of the circus that's currently going on.
You still there, Simon?
Looks like he's still listening, but he just dropped down.
It's possible there's connection issues, too.
Give him a couple minutes to see if he'll jump back on. Gabe, did we keep it light, tight, and bright for you today? I hope we didn't make it too doom and gloomy.
I think it's the exact conversation that we needed to have today. So I really appreciate Joe Carlisseri's viewpoints on things. His perspectives are level-headed. His delivery is punctual and effective. And so that's good. Helps us to, I think that it's important to maintain an objective view on things as much as we can. Of course, we're humans. We're going to have reactions to stuff, but it's good to have level-headedness and to be the calm one in the room. Especially right now, because we've got so much of a roller coaster going on. And Alex, I think you used the word circus when it comes to the elections. And I mean, I don't even know if that word is strong enough, but it's important, especially knowing what we know and seeing the reason for hope that we see. It's important for us to be able to approach things from a level-headed perspective and to be the calm ones in the room while everybody else is losing their minds, because I think that we're going to see more of that coming in the future. So it was a good conversation.
I agree with that. Simon, you're back up here. Did you hear Alex's question about the election from an outsider's view?
Yeah, really sorry. I had a call come through. Do you want to ask the question again, Alex?
Yeah, I was just curious, Simon, what a non-US person thinks of the current election, and just get your kind of viewpoint. Because yeah. To us, it's here, it's like it's a gigantic circus, in my opinion. I just wonder what you think, and if you think, you know, one candidate might be better than another, or just what your thoughts are in general.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got a lot of criticisms of Trump, but if I were American, I'd be voting Trump. I'll say that up front. From a kind of a non-American map of the world, I come from an ideology of fix money, fix the world. And then the most important second factor, well, not even second factor, I see it as unsolvable. But the war are the only things that I really concern myself with. I really don't want to go into World War III. And I think the next president of the United States is going to be doing some serious negotiations and is going to have to stand up to forces that are much, much more powerful than how I think the people think the world works, i.e. stand up to intelligence agencies, stand up to the Federal Reserve, and actually implement a structure to maybe free America one day from the Federal Reserve. So where I'm looking at, the crypto policy is really important to me. I'm deeply disappointed by this shitcoin project. I think it's a real slap in the face to the good momentum. I think RFK totally gets Bitcoin. He also gets, the entrenched interest. He comes from a family background of people that lost their life because of the deep state. And so I think RFK joining forces with Trump is the only real vote there. I really want to see a Bitcoin strategic reserve asset. I personally believe that implementing that strategy, not on the Fed's balance sheet, but on the government's balance sheet, is hugely important. So one day America can have banking reform and return back to its pre-1913 financial system before the Fed built this this debt bubble that's ballooning. And I know Joe has got very good ways of managing it, but it's still predatory on wealth inequality and society and all the side effects that come from it. I think also, to me, it's very important that Trump has made a commitment. He has made the commitment before and didn't follow through with it. But I think America really deserves the truth around what happened on 9/11, what happened to JFK. I actually think what you will find in those documents relative to a different narrative that you're fed may actually get Americans educated and understanding who their friends are and who their enemies actually really are. And so Trump is the only one that's made a commitment to those, but I have less than 1% faith that Trump will be able to stand up to those forces, because I think the 2016 Trump that wanted to drain the swamp has been co-opted into the 2024 Trump. So I don't see a power structure change here. I've got like that less than 1% hope that Trump is actually going to do what he originally intended on doing. But when you follow the money and look at who his political campaign financing is, there's going to be massive escalations in the Middle East. And I don't believe his anti-war policy, because he took $100 million in order to annex Gaza and hand it over to Israel and make Israel bigger, which the rules of engagement right now is that Putin has said, for every amount of money that the UK and the US and Europe fund over to Ukraine, he's going to double their support for Iran. And then China's sitting by the side and wants to be the negotiator of peace. So, you know, that's a force that the next president of the United States has to manage. And to me, the thought of Kamala Harris managing that, I think we get a much, much bigger NATO. I think you get a much, much bigger debt. And I don't think you get anywhere closer to fixing the money, fixing the world. So to me, it's a one vote. That's how I think about it. Unfortunately, they're all co-opted into, you know, having, you know, RFK, Trump and Kamala, you know, they've all been bought by Israel. So unfortunately, they'll call out NATO. And so the Trump administration will call out NATO. It looks like Kamala Harris won't. They'll support NATO. But they won't call out the whole Iran-Israel side. And so that's where I say is the to me, that's the best pick for Trump. That's how I see it on my side.
How do you view Biden right now? How does the media portray him where you're at?
I think the current president of the United States is Antony Blinken. I don't think it's Biden at the moment. Biden is just doing nothing. The world is very upset because he lied on national TV on October the 7th and said that there were 40 beheaded babies, which created a chain of events that may take us to World War III based upon a lie. And so that is incredibly destructive. And I think he'll be remembered for that. And so I hope the world punishes Biden, Kamala Harris, and the Democrat administration for the death and destruction that they've caused to so many people by supporting a genocide.
And I think that kind of fits into a narrative where they may be pushing for an escalation with Russia, just so that they have an excuse to stay in power longer. So we appreciate that, those views, Simon.
Yeah, sorry they're so dark, but the only thing that gives me light at the end of the tunnel is not the hope in governments, but the hope in Bitcoin and decentralized finance. And that's why I think, you know, all of these crypto scam projects and stuff that Trump's been involved in, I think it distracts him from the real solution and the real problems. But fortunately, we can all opt out of central banks. We can all opt out. And, you know, Bitcoin's given us that way of peacefully transitioning from fiat currency proof of weapons to peaceful Bitcoin proof of work. And I just hope more and more people find it, because I think it's going to be the only thing that many of us are holding on to and gives us the ability to use our wealth in order to exert influence to try and make these governments smaller and stand up to some of these things. Also grateful for freedom of speech as well. I think Elon Musk gave us an amazing service. For the last year, we've been able to communicate with each other through freedom of speech. And I think all of us have learned so much, and Elon gave us that gift, and just being able to respectfully engage in different narratives and understand different perspectives so we can try and push back on our governments. So that gives me hope.
Absolutely. And that's what our mission is. Make people understand that Bitcoin helps us achieve our goal of freedom, privacy, self-reliance. So I want to thank everybody who jumped up here today. We went a little bit past, but we had a great conversation. So I think that's a great way to go into the weekend. Make sure you guys check us out every Monday through Friday. We do this live, 9 o'clock.
Oops, I think I just unmuted myself. So we do this live every Monday through Friday, 9 o'clock Central Time. Make sure you have us on the background. We have a lot of great discussions going on here, and it wouldn't be made possible without everybody who came up. So I want to thank, again, Simon. I really appreciate you coming on. AC, Gabe Lord, Terrence, Alex. It really means a lot. And Jacob for helping us out in the background. And everybody in the audience who was listening, taking notes, or just had us on so they didn't have to hear the voices in their head. I really do appreciate it. If you're a veteran and you're listening to this, make sure you reach out to us. Send us a DM and we'll put you in a connection with one of our community members. We have over 600 vets and we are growing. Check us out, get on the podcast, and I will see you all on Monday. Go crush it.